So now I want to look at your handout that you have. The second page of it, Clyde reproduced this leftover material from chapter 10. On corporate, chapter 10D, the environment, and it says CAFE standards or corporate average fuel economy standards for automobile mileage. So that's what I want to talk about here for a few minutes before we go on to affirmative action. Corporate average fuel economy means the average miles per gallon required for cars, trucks, for each U.S. manufacturer per year. Now, the United States can't regulate what overseas countries do. They can, you know, you can have a car company in Japan or Germany or South Korea or something. They can do what they want. But for the United States, there are laws that regulate how many miles per gallon General Motors, Chrysler, Ford has to have on average in the cars they produce every year. And I'll give you kind of a summary of this. I think it started out, it was kind of, let's reduce our dependence on foreign oil, on especially Arab oil nations. So we'll try to cut back the miles, we'll cut back the fuel usage by increasing miles per gallon. And so in 75 to 78, cars averaged 18 miles per gallon. That was the rule. And then in 1979, it went to 19 miles, or was 18 miles per gallon, and then 19 miles per gallon in 79 for cars and 17 miles per gallon for trucks. 1990, 27.5 miles per gallon for cars and light trucks. Cars and light trucks, 20 miles per gallon. And then in 2009, 23 miles per gallon. That's about where we are now. Well, that sounds great. We're saving oil. It started out to be reduced dependence on foreign oil, but then another reason came along. And the other reason is what is really driving this push to more and more miles per gallon for cars. What is that reason? Why do people want to have us burn less oil? Hmm? It's not the cost, no? It's global warming. See, because when you drove your car, according to global warming advocates, or people who say that we have a dangerous problem with global warming, when you drove your car to church this morning, you produced carbon dioxide. And your carbon dioxide is destroying the earth. Therefore, let's get you to burn less oil. That produces carbon dioxide. Now, when I talked about global warming, my conclusion on that was that the data has been skewed and wrongly reported from this East Anglia Climate Research Center, where the temperature data was coming from. There were all sorts of errors that were eventually disclosed by this email, bunch of emails being released. But also from a theological standpoint, it seemed to me very unlikely that God would set up a world in such a way that we would destroy it by doing morally good things, like driving our car to church or turning on the lights here this morning so we can see inside. Now, that's energy being produced by, at least in some cases, coal and oil, not all by nuclear. And so all this energy use, the theory is increasing global warming, so we've got to decrease energy use. And the way to decrease energy use is to force manufacturers to get more miles per gallon out of their cars. And when you first hear that, you think, well, that's a great idea. We like to get more miles per gallon because, oh, somebody said cost. Yeah, because then I won't have to spend so much money on gas. That's a great idea. Let's get more miles. Let's force those car manufacturers to get more miles per gallon. Well, when you start out way back in 1978, there are some things that you can do in terms of, you know, tricks that engineers can come up with about reducing the friction in the engine and getting more power out of the, more efficiency so that the percentage of energy that's actually produced when the gasoline ignites in your engine, that energy is transferred to the drive shaft, and so the wheels are going around as a result of it, rather than energy just being lost and dissipated in heat or something like that. So there's a little bit you can do with engineering. But once you've done the best you can in terms of engineering the automobile, maybe reducing wind resistance, maybe making the engine better, then how else could you make these cars go farther on a gallon of gas? That's the goal. How can you do that? How can you make the car go farther? What could you do? Alan is saying you could make it smaller and lighter. See, here's the theory. How far will a go-kart go on a gallon of gas? A go-kart might go 200, 300 miles on a gallon of gas. So let's make everybody drive go-karts. Wow, that would increase miles per gallon, wouldn't it? Well, that would just increase the miles per gallon, and we'd have all our energy, all our global warming contributions reduced by everybody driving go-karts. What's the problem with driving a go-kart? Safety. Rosemary? Not safe to drive a go-kart. What else is the problem with driving a go-kart? You can't carry anything, says the contractor in my front row here. Can't carry lumber or anything. What else is wrong with a go-kart? It's too slow. Okay, what else? Uncomfortable to sit in the go-kart. Okay, what else? Oh, wait a minute. Who said this? You can't carry people? Yeah, Rosemary. You can't carry anybody else in a go-kart. Like if you want to carry, like John's sitting here, you might want to bring Sandy along. And you can't carry kids in a go-kart. And you can't carry much groceries in a go-kart. So making everybody drive go-karts would solve the mileage problem. But, what happens in a go-kart? We don't worry about this too much in Arizona. But there's another problem with a go-kart when it rains. Okay, and what about when you get in an accident? Oh, not very much protection. But that is the only route left to go. Once you've made the engineering changes that you can make in an engine, the only way to make a car get more miles per gallon is make it lighter. And what happens then to the safety? It reduces. And to make it lighter and to make it smaller. And so, what if people say, I don't want to buy a lighter and smaller car. I want a safer, heavier car. And I want a bigger car because I want to carry groceries and kids and things in it. Or 4x8 sheets of plywood, says John, etc. What if people say, I don't want to buy a smaller car. I want to buy a bigger car. Well, then the government's answer is, we'll do two things. First, we'll make sure that that's the only car that you can afford by penalizing the companies if they make too many big cars. We give them fines that drive the cost of the big cars way up out of people's range. And the second thing we'll do is we'll call these tiny cars that nobody wants to drive that are not safe, we'll call them smart cars. And we'll fool everybody and think it's smart. Now look, if you want to buy a smaller car and you appreciate the gas mileage and it's economical and you want to do that, that's fine. I have no objection to that at all. But I do have objection to governments forcing us to do that and taking away the choice. And that's the problem with corporate average fuel economy. So that... let's look at the outline. Point B, violation of these CAFE standards means large government fines. CAFE reached by manufacturers by increased technology, that's what we talked about, and then switching to small vehicle manufacturer. There is point D, the technical improvements lead to higher priced vehicles. Well, okay, maybe people think that's worthwhile, that's fine. But there is a limited amount of energy available in a gallon of gas. Even if you use 100% of the energy that's there, that's all the energy that's there. So It only goes so far. And the smaller and lighter car manufacturer is the most practical means. Which means if the government forces General Motors, Chrysler, and Ford to get their average fuel economy higher, 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 then they've got to make more and more very small, very light cars. And even if people don't want to buy them, they just say, that's all we're going to produce. And we'll produce a few larger cars. What happened to, do you remember station wagons? What happened to station wagons? They couldn't meet the corporate average fuel economy standards by selling station wagons because they're too long and they're too heavy. So they just said, okay, we're not going to produce station wagons anymore. We used to drive a station wagon. We drove a station wagon because you could fit a lot of kids in it, and then you could fit groceries in the back, and you could fit suitcases, and you go on a long trip. But by introducing these CAFE standards and ratcheting them up more and more and more, the government basically took away the opportunity for Americans to buy station wagons. You might see a few, but they're very rare, and they're much more expensive for what you get for a car. So what did the car manufacturers do? They said, well, looks like we've got a way to get around this. Trucks. Trucks don't have to meet as stringent standards. And we will build we'll build a truck and put a box around it and call it a minivan. Or build a truck and put a box around it and call it an SUV. And so then they fall in the truck standards. But now, since President Obama had this new agreement with corporate average fuel economy standards about a year ago, these also are subject to more stringent standards, and I don't know what's going to happen with SUVs. Point I, choice of a large car. The opportunity to buy a large car for average American consumers is being systematically denied to us by the government. Smaller cars mean less protection. 27.5 mile per hour CAFE standards. Let me read this. What are the costs of these CAFE standards? Smaller cars are demonstrably more dangerous. The death rate in accidents in multi-vehicle crashes is twice as high in these mini cars as in large cars. Twice as high a chance of dying in an accident. What about in single vehicle crashes where a small car is involved and no other vehicles? Passengers in minis suffered three times as many deaths as in large cars. 2002, National Research Council found that the 27.5 mile per gallon CAFE standards contributed to about contributed to about 2,000 deaths per year through their restrictions on car size and weight. This is 2,000 more Americans dead each year simply because of CAFE requirements imposed by Congress. Point Q, if carbon fuels have almost no measurable effect on Earth's climate, as I argued a few weeks ago, then these CAFE standards are forcing Americans to drive smaller, less comfortable, more dangerous cars for no good purpose. And we haven't seen the worst of it yet, because this new agreement that President Obama made May 19, 2009, with General Motors and Chrysler, both which were under federal government control at the time, to institute a huge increase of CAFE standards from 27.5 to 35.5 miles per gallon by 2016. That's coming on us in 4 years. Passenger cars would have to average 39 miles per gallon. SUVs and minivans will also have to be factored into the overall formula. This will require even smaller and lighter cars, as well as, here's the new solution, switching to more expensive hybrid or all-electric cars. Well, you say, and I have friends who have some hybrid cars, Well, what's the benefit of that? I might even get one myself for some year for just driving around town, which is convenient. It's like driving a golf, kind of a big golf cart. It kind of sounds the same. But are they more expensive or less expensive? Right now, they're more expensive. And so the government says, but wait a minute, we've got to make people buy these. What can we do? We will give a rebate. Now I just got to ask you, who pays for that rebate? Jack does, right here, sitting in the third row. He raises his hand. Rebates come out of our tax money. So if these hybrid cars were more economical in themselves, you wouldn't need to give people a rebate. People would just do the math. They'd say, wait a minute, I get more miles per gallon. This is great. And if that happens, then and you want to do that and the convenience works out, that's fine. But why should the government do this to subsidize from all of our tax money people to buy cars that are more expensive to drive? Hybrid cars are still more expensive to drive. At least that's what I've read. Okay, that's corporate average fuel economy. It's just another example, I think, of government trying to micromanage our lives and gain more and more control over our lives. So the essence of political liberalism, I came back, in the environment, it's fear of using resources rather than joyful, wise use, and that affects our view of global warming, and this affects let's not let people use gasoline anymore, let's reduce it. And in then another aspect in this chapter 15, the essence of liberalism is minute regulation of everyone's lives through rules made by unelected bureaucrats. And I think these CAFE standards are actually made by elected bureaucrats in Congress, sadly. They sound innocent, but they're not really helping us, and they're not giving us the freedom to drive what we want to drive. Do you want to ask about that for a minute before I go to cap and trade? Maybe, you know, it's possible I'm misunderstanding something here. John?
And people say you're going to reduce emissions because you're driving electric cars. Where do you get the power? Where you plug into the wall, where does that come from?
It comes from a coal-burning electric plant or an oil-burning electric plant. It's still using carbon.
The only point that I'm trying to make is it takes so much energy to transport you or me from here to...
Yeah, and the energy has to come from somewhere.
And the energy comes from somewhere, and the emissions are going to go somewhere.
Right.
And I think we're fooling ourselves.
Yeah. But there are certain people in government that like to tinker with everybody's lives.
Well, the other thing about it, the worst thing you could have in Arizona for a car is a battery.
Ah, yeah.
And the battery's in a what do you call it, alternate car or $8,000?
Hybrid car, yeah. In the all-electric car is $8,000 battery.
Yeah. If your battery blows up.
Mm-hmm. So that's rather expensive. A lot of miles per gallon. Okay. One more, then we're done. What's your name?
My name's John Brawley.
John?
Yeah, from Portland.
Hi.
Actually, hi. There is some talk about the dangers of the lithium battery in the hybrid cars. So, you know, they're going to the hybrid car for the environment, but the disposal of the battery and the creation of it poses a problem as well. So.
No magic solution. Okay, now let's go on to CAFE standards. Oh, I guess I just have that on the bottom of the outline. No, we did that. Cap and trade, point B. As currently proposed, cap and trade is a system that would allow the government to control energy use. What is this? Cap. What does cap mean? Government would say, first of all, you have a cap on the carbon emissions you can produce. And first of all, this would apply to companies and factories. So I've got to think of a factory. Let's see. Let's say you've got a factory. Well, let's say you've got a paper mill that's producing paper. Okay. Now, say you're producing paper. You're using X amount of energy per year. That's the average for the last 3 years. You've got, let's say, 100 units of energy you've used, huge units. That's your cap. That's all you can use. Can't use any more. And they say that to all the factories in the United States, all right? Now, Let's say you want to expand your factory and make more paper. Sorry, you can't do that. You've already got a cap on the energy that you can use. What do you mean you can't expand? Sorry, you can't expand. Well, how can we get our cap raised? You can buy energy credits from another company. Really? Yep. It's just going to cost you a lot of money. So that's the trade part. There's another paper mill down the street. No, maybe there's something else. What could be a manufacturing thing? I need a small manufacturer.
Widgets.
Everybody wants to manufacture widgets. Okay, I don't know what a widget is. Okay, so a widget factory down the road, and you say, you know, you can sell us 10 of your energy credits. How much? Oh, $1 million apiece. Oh, great. Okay. So they trade by the paper mill, buys 3 of these energy credits for $1 million apiece, or 10 of them for $1 million apiece. And that rewards the widget factory. Well, how are they going to lower their cap? They're going to shut down part of their factory. See, okay, hey, we can make money by closing down part of our... We'll close down this whole wing of our widget factory. And so now, what are you doing? You're rewarding one company for producing less. Somebody in the audience who has an understanding of economics should start to say, you're rewarding people for producing less? Does that help the economy? Well, it's reducing energy usage. So the trade is the paper mill buys these energy credits from the widget factory. The widget factory gets $10 million. It gets rewarded for producing less. And the paper mill wants to expand and make more paper. It's got an added $10 million cost. It gets penalized for producing more. But now it's got it's traded to get its energy cap raised up from 100 units to, I don't know what, 110 or something like that. So cap and trade starts out as a system where you stop energy usage at a certain level, and then you penalize people who produce more, which use, you know, they expand their factory, they produce more, they run their factory longer, they produce. You penalize those people, and you reward people who produce less. That's economically backwards. But here's the kicker. Next thing the government does is say, well, you had 100 units for your cap last year. Guess what? It's going to be 95 this year and 90 the next year. And now we're going to ratchet the cap down so you have to use less and less energy. And the paper mill says, well, then I've got to shut down part of my factory. Too bad. The whole goal is to reduce energy consumption. Cap, and then bring the cap down, because we fear using energy. Why? Because global warming tells us we're destroying the planet and we've got to use less energy. Does that make sense? That's cap and trade. Sherry, in the way back, that is Sherry, I think.
Reduces the job market because there's fewer jobs.
Yep.
And then also the jobs are going to go to the big corporations that can buy these extra credits.
Yeah, they have caps to buy
so
the extra
credits. So it hurts small business.
Yep. Yep, yep. But you reduce you shut down a wing of the factory to reduce your cap, get your cap back down to the lower level, and then you reduce the jobs. And what happened to the widget makers? They lost their jobs because the company just said, hey, we can make a lot of money by selling our energy credits. So the purpose, point six under cap and trade, is to stop or slow global warming. And point eight, productive countries... companies penalized and unproductive companies rewarded. Point nine, this is backwards. This is economically backwards. 1 Peter 2:14 says that government is to punish those who do evil and reward those who do good, or praise those who do good. This is rewarding those who do something bad. That is reducing the economic production that they have. And it's punishing those who do good. That is increasing economic production and help adding more jobs and adding more goods to the society. So the likely result of cap and trade number 10 is it will hinder economic productivity and drive up prices very significantly because it costs companies more to comply with these energy caps on energy. Now, you say, wait a minute. It's going to drive up prices for everybody. It's going to drive down production. Of course, we don't want that. This is bad. But the problem is there are people in government who think it's good to drive up prices for everybody in America. Why? Because this will make a rich nation like the United States poorer. And this will make us more equal to the rest of the world. And that's what we want. We want the United States to be poorer because we want the United States to be like the rest of the world because we don't like this, some nations being really rich and some nations being really poor. And the second reason is it will force people to reduce energy use, and that's the goal, to reduce energy use. My response to all that is it's wrong. God gave us abundant energy sources in the earth to make life easier and more enjoyable. Last week we talked about the new rules for washing machines, so they have to be side-loading rather than top-loading, so none of them get clothes clean and they get moldy, and you don't, because you don't use much water and you don't use much electricity. But now Wall Street Journal Consumer Report saying no washing machines currently on the market that they tested get clothes really clean. So, okay, by new government regulations, our lives are dirtier. And then you have the rules for energy usage reduction that drive us to use these high-efficiency light bulbs that don't turn on. That is, they don't light up. So I've got to wait in the hallway for a minute until I can see the thermostat that I'm trying to read after I switch the light on. Or till I can see what color socks I'm putting on in the when I run in, go in the closet to get some socks because the light doesn't go on. It's because we're reducing energy usage. So my life becomes dirtier with dirty clothes. It becomes darker with lights that don't work, and it becomes more dangerous with smaller cars that don't keep me safe. My response is that God gave us abundant energy sources in the earth to make life easier, more enjoyable, not darker, dirtier, and more dangerous. Genesis 1:28, where God told Adam and Eve to subdue the earth, implied that we should use the resources of the earth, and I think that means we should use more energy because God gave us abundant sources of energy. And I went through that data on 1,000 years worth of oil left, maybe more, 1,000 or more years of coal left, nuclear energy, abundant. There's abundant energy on the earth. Use energy, use more energy. It's abundant, and enjoy a brighter, safer, cleaner, happier life. All right, that's cap and trade. Anybody want to object to that? I mean, maybe I'm misstating something or overstating something, so I want to be corrected if you want to disagree with me. Okay. I mean, if you think this is exciting, wait till we come to farm subsidies next week. I mean, how many churches can you go to learn about farm subsidies anyway? Okay, or cap and trade. All right. Let's go on to the front of your outline, affirmative action and gender-based quotas. Point D on the front. Anybody need an outline? Clyde has been so good to get these outlines out. Anybody need one? No? We're okay. Good. Affirmative action refers to government policies that give preferential treatment to members of certain minorities in education, in employment, and in awarding government contracts to businesses. Now, what are the arguments in favor of affirmative action? A, they provide more diverse representation of all segments of society in different areas. And B, they're needed to overcome past discrimination against certain minority groups. So certain rules that say in certain hiring areas and in certain educational areas and certain government contracts, we need to have a certain percentage of minorities awarded these educational privileges or these contracts or these jobs. The disadvantage, now, look, I think when we first hear about this, there's something in us that says this makes sense. If we have a history of discrimination against minority groups in the United States, then laws that say let's overcome that discrimination and try to right it by giving preferential hiring and contracts and educational opportunities to minority groups. Well, that sounds at first like a good idea. And, you know, maybe for a time there was some justification for this. I'm not sure. I'm not saying that it was always wrong. But there are some definite disadvantages as that system has persisted. The disadvantages are this, are these. Affirmative action programs are inherently discriminatory against groups that are not favored by the policy. For example, in New Haven, Connecticut, the fire department gave a test to see which firefighters would qualify for a promotion. 118 firefighters applied to try to get promoted to lieutenant or captain. 56 passed the really hard test, and they'd studied for weeks and weeks and months. But 56 passed, but there were only a limited number of vacancies. There were only 19 vacancies for lieutenant or captain. The top 19 scores were 17 whites and 2 Hispanics, and no black firefighters of the 27 with passing scores were eligible. So the city said, wait a minute, we can't award these 19 jobs to only the whites and Hispanics who got the top scores. We're going to invalidate the test score results, and we'll use other means to decide on promotion. Even though all the firefighters had been warned a long time in advance, you know, the test score is going to determine who gets these jobs. Well, the 19 firefighters who were in the top scores, and some of them didn't get the job, then they sued. And they filed a lawsuit against New Haven, Connecticut, and they said, we've been discriminated against because we're white or Hispanic. And that's unconstitutional, because the 14th Amendment to the Constitution says no state may deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of laws. And that was to overcome racial discrimination passed in 1868 in the United States. It was to overcome discrimination against blacks who had been slaves, but doesn't it also apply equally to discrimination against whites and Hispanics? Well, this case went all the way to the Supreme Court. So the Supreme Court heard the case and decided it in the case Ricky V. DiStefano. It was announced June 29, 2009, and the court, by a 5-4 vote, ruled that New Haven, Connecticut was wrong to ignore the test results, and the 17 whites and 2 Hispanics who got the top scores deserved the jobs. That case illustrates the difficulties of this question. If the test was a fair measure of the ability to do the job, then the fire department, in changing the basis for hiring, ended up hiring less qualified people to be promoted. In previous years, American society had wrongfully discriminated against blacks. But now this kind of affirmative action was wrongly discriminating against whites and Hispanics. But now, speaking as a Christian, based on teachings of the Bible, I would say that all human beings are created in the image of God, deserve equal treatment in the image of God, and have equal status before God. Then it seems to me that hiring decisions should be entirely free of racial considerations. There shouldn't be any discrimination against blacks or whites or Hispanics or any other ethnic group. And that's what the Supreme Court, by a 5-4 majority, held. Another difficulty with affirmative action programs is it tends to cast doubt on the qualifications of all members of the minority who are appointed to a position. And it tends, therefore, to perpetuate the separation of American society into different racial groups, the not favored group feeling resentment, the favored group wondering, would my qualifications really have been enough to get me the position anyway? And thus, it seems to me that affirmative action, while probably well-intended at the beginning, serves more to perpetuate a sense of racial division and divisiveness in U.S. society. Because you're always wondering, did that person get that job because of qualifications or because of racial preferences? Reverse discrimination. Another result, and this is a very sad situation, result of affirmative action policies in law schools is probably that there are fewer black attorneys today than there would otherwise be. Why? Because, and there's this study that I quote at some length by Richard Sander. It's an article in Stanford Law Review in 2004 where he did statistical studies on admissions to law schools, graduation from law school, and then passing the bar exam and actually practicing law. And and he said there's a racial disparity in passing the bar exam and actually practicing law, and it comes about because of affirmative action at law school admissions. And here's what happens. He said, law school admissions practices at the very top tier elite school and then throughout the other law schools. It's a very competitive situation. They admit about 14% more black applicants than they would if they just based the qualification, the admissions on test scores and qualifications. About 14% more. What happens is that happens at the very top tier schools. And when they admit more students that would otherwise have gone to the second tier law schools, then the second tier law schools have to admit more black students who would normally have gone to the third tier law schools. And there's a domino effect all the way down the line. Overall, 14% more are admitted because of affirmative action policies. What happens when you get into a very, very elite law school and you don't have the academic record or qualifications to compete with the other law school students there? You end up on the bottom of the class. So he says, sadly, I should emphasize point E first. When black and white students of the same academic level compete in the same law school, they earn about the same grades and pass the bar at about the same rate. But under affirmative action policies, 45% of black law students pass the bar exam on the first try versus 78% of white law students who pass the bar exam on the first try. Black law school students, only 57% pass after multiple tries at the bar exam. And then under F, your outline, page one, under 4F, your outline, line two, 57% pass after multiple tries, and there's a misprint there. It should say 43% never go on to become attorneys. 43% never go on to become attorneys. Because all the way down the scale of law schools, they're all put in places that are too hard for their academic skills. 78% pass on the first try. Yeah, though Vic is thinking there should be fewer attorneys in the world anyway. So I don't have that, but 78% pass on the first try as opposed to 45% of black law students. So the result is that 43% don't go on to become attorneys, and they're saddled with enormous debt, often $160,000 or more, plus undergraduate debt, with no viable means to replace that debt. Sander says the solution is abolish affirmative action for law schools. They say that 86% of blacks currently admitted to some law school would still gain admission, but they would be admitted to schools where they would rank equal to everybody else according to their qualifications, and more of them would pass the bar at significantly higher rates than they do now. And so Sanders says if we eliminated affirmative action, we'd have more black lawyers in the United States than we do by having them continually competing in law schools where they just are overwhelmed by the academic demands and often rank in the bottom of their grade point average, in the bottom of their law schools. In elite law schools, 51.6% of black students were in the bottom 10% of their class, as opposed to 5.6% of white students. This is a terrible situation and shouldn't be happening, but it's misguided government policy or misguided affirmative action policy. My Jack, okay, this guy warning me on time here. Let me just say my own conclusion on this. I agree the United States must not forget that we have a tragic history of racial discrimination against blacks in particular. But programs of affirmative action just prolong another type of racial discrimination and perpetuate racial divisiveness and animosity, along with a sense of insecurity and questions about their own abilities on the part of those who do qualify for such positions. Seems to me a crucial step toward overcoming racial differences that remain in U.S. society is a complete abolition of all affirmative action policies in law and business and government once and for all. I agree that instances of actual discrimination should be illegal, but I don't think there should be any policies based on presumed discrimination based on numerical quotas or just trying to get desired outcomes. And as I said, I think that these affirmative action policies are actually contrary to the Constitution itself, as the Supreme Court recently affirmed in this Rickey versus DiStefano case. Okay, that's affirmative action. Now, I have a few minutes, and I'm going to press on and see if I can get caught up on my outline here. Gender-based quotas. Because after that, I get to do farm subsidies. And that's where I want to be next week. All right, I just want to say something about gender-based quotas. These require a certain percentage, sometimes equal percentage, of women and men in government-based employment, in business contracts, in college sports activities, and other places. The difficulty is the number of women that must be enrolled in a given program is arbitrary and artificially imposed. And the big problem is a law called Title IX passed in 1972 that said schools must offer scholarships and program funding in athletics roughly equal to the school's overall male and female populations. Now, that sounds like a good thing. Girls should be able to get athletic scholarships as well as boys. Anything wrong with that? Well, the problem is that what if more boys than girls want to compete in college sports? Say, what if a college is admitting 1,000 students a year and 300 want to compete in college sports? 1,000 boys, 1,000 girls. 300 boys want to compete in college sports and 200 girls want to compete in college sports. Now, what does the government say? You've got to make it equal. Well, you can do a little bit by kind of trying to offer more incentives or scholarships. Maybe you get it up to 220 women that want to compete in college sports. But let me tell you, there are some women that don't want to compete in college sports. The government says it doesn't matter. If you've got 220 women in college sports, and that's all that you have competing in college sports, then you've got to only have 220 men in college sports. Wait a minute, says the college. We've got a lot more men than women that want to be in college sports. It doesn't matter. We're the government. You've got to have an equal number. Well, we've only got 220 women in college sports, and even that's after extensive recruiting and generous scholarships and everything else we can do. We still only got 220. The government says, then you've got to cut the number of men in college sports down to 220 and make it even. No, we won't do that, says the college. Okay, then we won't give you any government money, says the government. And the college says, okay, we give up. Without government money, we can't survive. Therefore, we will cut some men's sports programs. And as a result, San Jose State University, California, had a nationally ranked male soccer team, had to cut it. Also had to cut its men's gymnastics and tennis programs because they were spending some money on non-revenue generating or revenue losing female sports in order to provide equal opportunity. National Wrestling Coaches Association says that 350 men's wrestling coaches programs have been cut nationwide. The losses for men's sports have been in sports such as swimming, wrestling, track, and gymnastics. Now my question is this. If people are completely free to follow their own preferences and desires, is it possible that more women than men, is it possible that more men than women will choose to be involved in competitive sports at the university level? Is it possible? Yes, I think that's entirely possible. That's just saying there might be different distribution of preferences between men and women. Now, just one factual observation. It seems to me that there is far more spectator interest in watching men's sports than women's sports at the university level and the level of professional sports. Note the weekend sports programming on TV, or the spectators in the stands at college sports. Both men and women give substantially more time and money to watching men's sports than women's sports. I don't think this is because of wrongful discrimination. It's just differences in preferences for sports activities as compared to other activities between men and women. And I don't think government bureaucrats should try to force men and women into artificial compliance with their preconceived policies that are anti-democratic and anti-liberty. Now, look, I want to be sure that I'm clear. I think it's important that universities devote substantial funding and attention and facilities to women's sports programs as well as men. That's not the question. The question is whether the government should force the universities to have an absolutely equal number of men and women enrolled in these sports programs. Related question. What about allowing women to compete in boys' wrestling teams or boys' football teams? It's a related question. If you assume that there are no inherent differences between men and women, you say, what's the big deal? Of course women should be allowed equal opportunity to be on a boys' wrestling team in high school. But there are very serious problems, I think. If a boy in a wrestling match is assigned to wrestle against a girl on a high school team, he faces an impossible choice. If he loses to a girl, it's a badge of shame that will, I think, properly challenge his feelings of masculine strength and his sense of physical ability to protect others, perhaps for years to come, if he loses. And certainly it will challenge his, give him shame among his peers in the high school. But if he wins, he's become guilty of physically overpowering a woman against her will and doing so in a way that is never appropriate for a man to do against a woman in any circumstance at all, except perhaps to stop her from committing a violent crime. In the wrestling match, a boy is forced to act in violation of a deep-seated, God-given instinct that his role in the world is to be a protector and defender and respecter of the wonderful gift of womanhood. Encouraging violence against a woman and the aggressive attitude that the violence must entail in order to be successful is encouraging him to have exactly the wrong attitude toward women, an attitude that biblical standards of manhood would not allow him to have. And the contrast likewise encourages in young women a physically aggressive, hostile, violent attitude toward a man that will in the future hinder the development of healthy relationships with men. In addition, wrestling involves intensely close physical contact, even with the genital area and a woman's breasts. That means on another level, a boy wrestler is compelled to violate standards of decency and physical touch in areas where, outside of marriage, he has no right to be. And a girl wrestler has to engage in a contest where that kind of contact is expected and considered normal. It's the result of a government-sponsored attempt to deny the distinctive sexuality of men and women and to deny the essential differences between men and women as given by God. So my own view is that Christian coaches of wrestling teams who respect and honor the goodness and masculinity and femininity given us by God should resign rather than allow themselves to be compelled to endorse this kind of activity. And some have done that. And Christian parents of both boys and girls pushed into such situations should likewise withdraw their children from participation rather than forcing them at such a young age, and often without mature understanding of differences between men and women, forcing them to violate the moral patterns of Scripture. Government tampering with our lives. Cars, affirmative action, sports teams, wrestling teams, all things that are taking away our freedom, taking away our opportunity to choose and determine what we want to be and what we want to do, forced on us by an overly intrusive government. That's all I want to say about that. We have 5-7 minutes to have questions, I think. I can go on to farm subsidies. I mean, no. I forgot your name. Lisa? It is Lisa. Yeah.
While I understand your position on Title IX, don't you think that because of Title IX, girls and women now have many more opportunities to participate?
Yep.
So before Title IX, let's say, there wasn't women's soccer or or running or what have you. And now, because there are these sports in place, it's drawn out the number of women.
Thank you, Lisa, for saying that, because I was just having a sense that it wasn't coming through clearly. It's one of those things that started out with a good idea, and it wanted to probably correct some imbalance and some wrongful neglect of women's sports. And I don't want to endorse that. It's just this forcing into making everybody equal and not allowing enough freedom for people to choose what they want to do. It seems like it's gone way too far. That's all. And I, you know, Margaret, we didn't have girls. We had sons. But I've got two granddaughters now growing up, and I want them to have opportunities for school, for college scholarships, too. Sure, I agree with that. But I just, it grieves me when, by government compulsion, all these men's teams are squelched. That's all. Okay, got Vic in the back here.
Just a couple comments. One thing, I'm going to go back quite a ways. If you look at our education system and our medical system, for years, women didn't have any opportunities other than education and become nurses. So we had the best of the best going in those two fields, and yet they had every right, and they should have the right, to be in business and be doctors and lawyers and so forth and so on.
Yep.
If I look back at the business school, I had the good fortune going to one of the top five schools in the country as an undergraduate, and I can remember all the women coming in, and we had these government programs that I don't think if we did not have those, they would not have those opportunities today.
Yep.
And I was thinking about the analogy when he was talking about wrestling and sports, and I was carrying it with that same analogy in business today. Well, we had the same competition, and yet I think it's very positive. I had the opportunity to work for a woman CEO for a short period of time. So I sort of sat there and said, I don't like government regulation. I hate government regulation. At the same time, I would say, what else could we have done differently to make change?
Yeah.
And there's a balance there. It gets overdone oftentimes. But it's, I don't have any answers. I thought about it.
Okay. So, Vic, what you're making me see is, because I'm agreeing with what you're saying as I hear you saying it, what you're making me see is that I see a mistake that's gone because something has gone too far. But just like with affirmative action, I think it started out with a good idea and perhaps was necessary for a time to correct some, I don't know if it was necessary or not for a time to correct some imbalances. But, I just agreed with Lisa that the increase in women's scholarships in sports, perhaps they were way too few early on, was a good thing. But it was this government heavy-handedness saying, now everybody's got to be equal. And I think what's behind it is, we can't allow into our thinking the idea that men and women might be different. That's the problem. I might have different preferences, and not trying to force people into situations they don't really seek.
Well, I think one of the things of being an employer in the past is that when I would hire people, and I know most people don't have these standards, but I always looked at aptitude, skills, motivation, do they fit the culture?
Yep.
I didn't care whether they're black or red or white or women. But it worked.
Yep. So. Yeah. But my objection is the government forcing you to say, you can't, that doesn't count. You've got to have X number of people, either a racial minority or a gender equality.
I agree with you. It's just like, how do you force change?
Yep.
You have people
narrow-minded. But,
and
but,
I've been there.
But no matter what, I think right now we're at the point where these things have outlived their usefulness and they're really doing more damage than good. I've got a minute or two left. I've got one here and then back there.
Wayne, I'd like to go back to cap and trade. And I am sitting here thinking that theory of cap and trade could work marvelously if the government used it for the federal budget. I mean, this could really work with all the hot air.
Thank you, Aaron. We could call it cap and cut. Yeah. Actually, the political reality in the United States is now, since the November elections in 2010 and the Republicans gaining a majority in the House, the cap and trade legislation that President Obama was hoping to impose on the nation is dead. It's just not right now, not going to happen. But still, politically, half the country still wants this, or at least the more liberal political elements in the country still want cap and trade. And so the battle's not over, and it's good to realize what's going on. But it is an attempt to reduce overall energy consumption, which reduces overall economic productivity, which makes everything cost more and makes everybody, in essence, poorer. That's the game. Okay, one more. I saw way back here. Oh, yeah. You know what? What if I give that to Clyde and we hand it out next week, so that not only will you get to come for farm subsidies and tariffs, but we could talk about the essence of liberalism kind of as a review of chapters 5 to 15. Okay. Pray. Lord Jesus, we thank you. We thank you in spite of concerns that we have about our nation in areas such as we talked about today. We do thank you for allowing us to live in a nation where we have immense amounts of freedom and where you've allowed this nation to have immense amounts of economic productivity from which we all benefit. And so we thank you, Lord. And we ask that you'd fill our hearts with gratitude for the nation that we have and the freedom that we have, and that these concerns that we have, Lord, you'd help us to know how to address them and perhaps influence the direction of the nation regarding even these things. Lord, help people in government, especially pray for leaders in government working again and again on what to do about our national budget. Pray that you'd give them wisdom beyond their own ability, that you'd guide them and guide their hearts and enlighten them and help them to be wise. And in these areas that we talk about as well, we pray that you would bring wisdom to our leaders, that our country could more and more come into conformity with the principles and teachings of your word. Thank you for this opportunity to be together. In Jesus' name, amen. I did think about one thing to say about farm subsidies. If I said next week I'm going to talk about food prices and taxes, then probably it would be interesting. And that's what the farm subsidy question is. All right, food prices and taxes next week.